And we move to the third case today, Palka v. Shelton.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Counsel. We're here on the appeal of a 12B6 dismissal. And I want to remind the Court of that and remind us all of that, because sometimes in the course of going through the briefs, we forget that this is not here on a dismissal of a summary judgment motion. And the reason I point that out is because I think the Court, and sometimes in the arguments in the briefs, we forget that. The Court, in discussing the case below, went beyond looking at this case as a 12B6 motion and started to get into a discussion of the credibility and the facts. And I'd like to point that out to the Court in terms of where the specifics were and how the Court went beyond just looking at the facts well pleaded. For example, this is a case in which Mr. Palka had a son in the school, and by the way, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Palka's son was in the police academy. He was dismissed from the police academy. He went to the head of the police academy, Mr. Matt Tobias, who was an ADS Tobias, assistant deputy superintendent, and he complained. Mr. Ted Palka was a 28-year veteran of the sheriff's police. He was a deputy in the sheriff's police, and he talked to Mr. Tobias unsuccessfully. Mr. Tobias apparently felt threatened by that in some way, and after that occurred, Mr. Tobias then complained and said that Mr. Palka had made some phone call to his children's parochial school. Now, as we alleged in the complaint, Mr. Palka did not know Mr. Tobias had any children. With a name like Tobias, which is generally considered to be a Jewish name, he did not know that Mr. Tobias had children in a Lutheran parochial school. He didn't know where those children were in school. The call that he was alleged to have made was that he called the caller called the school and asked if there were children in the school because the caller said he wanted to send flowers. Mr. Tobias took that and said that that was a threatening phone call, that the school felt threatened by it, the principal felt threatened by it, that he and his family felt threatened by it, then Mr. Tobias felt that Mr. Palka was stalking him and his family, and filed a police report, got commander-level officers in the Chicago police to open up a file, use the LEAD system, which is supposed to be used for major felony prosecutions, to run reports on Mr. Palka and his son, and opened up a police investigative file, reported it to the sheriff's department, which got Mr. Ted Palka suspended, and eventually he was referred to the Merit System Protection Board. He would have been fired, so he resigned to protect his pension rather than to be terminated. And that's why he brought this action. And he brought it against the city, and he brought it against the sheriff's department. Those allegations were to be taken as true. Judge Kendall analyzed those allegations and made judgments on them. She then took those allegations and she made credibility determinations. For example,
Counsel, our standard of review is de novo, so
okay.
You don't need to focus on the district court's rationale. Just talk to us about why you should have
well,
a chance at
okay, she
developing
should not have done
the factual
that.
Record.
Okay, she should not have done that. A 12B6 motion is more appropriate. When you're looking at a 12B6 motion, you have to take those
Maybe
facts
as true.
Maybe you
should just start with the elements of the claim and tell us why your complaint, the most recent iteration of it, states the claim.
Number one, Mr. Palka alleged that he had a property interest because he had a job. He had a property interest in his job. He was a union member. He was de-deputized. Under the collective bargaining agreement, the Seventh Circuit has held that a government employee who was a member of a collective bargaining unit has a property interest in a job. We've cited the cases, the East Rutherford
provided
case.
Provided that the collective bargaining agreement provides protections against firing unless there's just cause, which there wasn't any allegation in the complaint about that. There wasn't any fleshing out of the terms of the collective bargaining agreement.
All collective bargaining agreements have protections in them. All collective bargaining agreements have a grievance and arbitration process. All collective bargaining agreements protect, by their very nature, but they have grievance and arbitration remedies.
That wasn't part of the complaint.
The East Rutherford case talks about all collective bargaining agreements have that. The very essence of a collective bargaining agreement is to protect an individual's job. if you have a contract. Otherwise, it's a you are terminable at will. The fact that you have a contract by its very nature means you cannot be terminated without some process by its very nature. Otherwise, it's terminable at will. The existence of a contract by its very nature provides you with protection. In addition, we cited you to cases involving professors where there was one case, the Patterson case, and also the case involving the University of Wisconsin, one where the individual was a tenured professor, where it was simply a question where he was a tenured professor and they wanted to transfer him, and he refused the transfer, and that was held to be the denial of a property where he had a property interest and due process rights. Another one where the person was denied tenure, and they said that the denial of tenure was a property right. And the threshold is very, very thin. The right of a job, if you can give a property interest for the fact that you are denied tenure, then the threshold to have a property right under the due process provisions and the constitutional protections of Section 1983 are not very high. And quite frankly, as the Supreme Court said in DePerry versus Sinderman and the Board of Regents versus Ross, if there are rules and procedures promulgated by the state officials to justify a process that allows you some kind of a due process protection if you're terminated, that provides or demonstrates the existence of a property interest. And we pointed this out in our reply brief. And you have the Merit System Protection Board process here. So the fact that you have a Merit System Protection Board process itself also shows that there's a property interest. So there was very clearly a property interest here in a job.
Could we, counsel, talk about the proceedings before the Merit Systems Protection Board? What exactly were the allegations that were made before the board?
The allegation that was made was the allegation that Mr. Tobias, ADS Tobias, charged against Mr. Palka, saying that he made a threatening phone call to the school, claiming that he made a threatening phone call to the school for the children, and that threatening phone call consisted of somebody with a quote-unquote Eastern European accent. I don't know how they could make that claim. I don't know how you can differentiate an accent as being Eastern European. But he claimed that a person with an Eastern European accent made a phone call to the school asking if there were children named Tobias at the school, and the secretary said yes.
Now, why weren't the protections of the Merit Systems Protection Board adequate to give your client procedural due process?
Because, as we also alleged in the complaint, in paragraphs 54 through 57, Chief Carrick talked to Mr. Palka and told him that he should resign, because he told him, basically, that the fix was in, that if he went to the Merit System Protection Board because of the fact that there was an allegation of claims made against children, threats made against a child, that he would lose, and that if he resigned, that the Merit System Protection Board action would go away, that his pension would be preserved, he would get his credentials, his firearms credentials, and his retirement badge, which would enable him to get another job in law enforcement protection.
Is your view then that the protections of the Merit System Protection Board and the courts in Illinois is not adequate?
Not per se, but in this particular instance at the Sheriff's Department, he was told by Chief Carrick that in this particular instance, that the Merit System Protection Board protection that was supposed to be available to him was not going to protect him.
So you're arguing that the board was rigged?
Right. He was told it. He was told that by Chief Carrick. He was told that if he went before the Merit System Protection Board, he was given a friendly word of advice by a chief that he should resign. When you're told by somebody in the political system that you ought to resign and save yourself the grief and protect yourself so that you protect your pension and your credentials so that you can work in law enforcement, generally speaking, when somebody tells you that in Chicago, you listen. And that's what he was told.
Well, that's not really a procedural due process claim. It may be nothing, but it's not a procedural due process claim. The process was adequate. The process was in place. The process was triggered and was underway, and there was nothing inadequate about it. His complaint is that he was faced with a hard choice, which is not a procedural due process claim.
Your Honor, I beg to differ with you. Let me put it to you this way. If you have a process that provides due process protection, and it works in 95% of the cases, and 5% of the cases it doesn't work, that's due process, because it gives you an opportunity for for justice. But what if it doesn't? What if it works in 99%? If it doesn't work in 99% of the cases, and 1% of the case it works, is that still due process? What if it works? It doesn't work in 100% of the cases. Is that due process? You have a situation here where somebody's telling you it's not going to work in 100% of the cases. It's the same thing as if it doesn't work at all. If you have a due process situation where it's not going to work in 100% of the cases because this man is telling you it's there but it won't work, is that providing you with due process protection? And I suggest to you it does not. If it provides one, if it's going to work at least 1% of the time, then the due process protection is there. It's not a very good due process protection, but at least it will have an opportunity to give you due process. But this is a man who's telling you it's not going to work. If it's not going to work, it's more illusory than real. It's not there.
So you're basically saying that the fix is a substantive due process problem?
Well, it's
the alleged fix?
You can call it whatever you want. It's just it's a lack of due process, period. He's not going to get it.
Call it something.
A substantive due process, if that's the way you want to characterize it, but he's not going to get his due process rights. It's not due process if it's not going to work.
Your client still had no obligation to exhaust the state remedies, both administrative and judicial.
You don't have the right. You, there's no point. There comes a time in law where if you know the process is not going to work, you have no obligation to exhaust it. If you know for certain it's not going to work, it's no different than a constructive discharge. If you know 100% of the, if you know that there's a 100% chance that it will not work, there is the doctrine of futility. There is a, it would have been futile for him to exercise the Merit System Protection Board process if he knows it's not going to work, and in fact, and if in exercising it, he's going to put himself at risk.
Because basically his adversary told him there was a fix.
That's correct. And I don't know how much clearer it could have been. He was delivered a message. If you exercise this process, you lose your pension, you lose your credentials, you lose everything. We also argued the procedural due process, which I've just discussed as well, and the substantive due process as well. We've argued that as well. There's also the occupational liberty claim, which is the issue of the credentials, which goes to the question of his credentials. Which actually, as it turned out to be, the promise was not delivered on. He did get his pension, but he did not get his credentials. And why is this important? Because without credentials, you can't get a job in law enforcement. Now, he was offered, if he went along with the program and he withdrew the claim and he resigned and this problem went away, nobody was embarrassed, he would get his retirement credentials. He would get his retirement badge, which... You know, the badge itself isn't really all that important, but he would get his retirement credentials. He would get his firearms credentials. He would have retired with honor. He's got an honorable discharge. The same thing as if retiring from the military, you get an honorable discharge. If you retire from the military with a dishonorable discharge, you get, that's a very black mark on your record. If you're in law enforcement, if you don't have your retirement credentials, you can't get another law enforcement job. You can't get any kind of a security job. So he was told, do this and you'll get your retirement credentials. So what happens? He does this and he doesn't get his retirement credentials. The sheriff's department holds it up. Why? Because he's got his case pending. He's got his claim pending. They held it hostage. You can't do that. You cannot deprive a person of their right to have a job. They've deprived him the right to work in law enforcement. They've deprived him of his occupational liberty. His right to work in law enforcement. What is this man supposed to do?
Do individuals who resign usually get their firearm credentials?
They all get them. They all get them.
So this is, in your view, being held up because of the pendency of this proceeding?
That's what we alleged in the complaint. And that has to be taken as true because that's what we alleged. Now, they've come back and they've thrown in facts that are not part of the record, which, of course, we've never gotten to because we haven't had the right to get into discovery. But we alleged in the complaint that everybody who retires gets their occupational liberty, gets their retirement credentials. And he retired as he was supposed to. And he didn't get it. And we've alleged the reason he didn't get it was because it was held up because he has the claim pending. So he's been deprived of his occupational liberty. That's the allegation. That must be accepted as true.
Is the claim still pending?
It is still pending. Well, it's still pending because of the appeal, obviously. So he's still being denied. He still has not gotten it.
The administrative proceeding, what is the status of that?
Well, there is no administrative proceeding. This is
well,
the claim.
You're talking about claim pending. You're talking about
this case.
This lawsuit.
Right. I see that my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Platt. Ms. Maloney?
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Carrie Maloney Layton. I represent the city defendants. Your Honors, in the district court, Mr. Palka raised an array of claims against both the individual city defendants as well as the city itself. In this court, however, the number of claims has dwindled significantly. Mr. Palka's reply brief did not respond to our arguments on his procedural due process claim against the individual city defendants or the Monell claim against the city. For that reason, this morning, I will limit my remarks to the claims Mr. Palka has not abandoned, the substantive due process and occupational liberty claims against the individual city defendants. For the remaining claims, as well as our qualified immunity defense, we will rest on our brief unless the court has specific questions. Turning first to Mr. Palka's substantive due process claim, Mr. Palka does not challenge the district court's holding that he failed to allege an essential element of his substantive due process claim, namely that there were inadequate state law remedies or he could establish an additional constitutional violation. Both of his briefs are silent on that element, and he has accordingly waived a challenge to the district court's judgment on that point. But even without regard to waiver, the district court was correct in holding that this circuit requires a showing of either inadequate state law remedies or an additional constitutional violation to make out a substantive due process claim. Mr. Palka does not plead that element, and he doesn't come before this court in his briefs or today claiming that he can satisfy it. Therefore, this court need not even reach the question of whether any individual city defendant's conduct rose to the level of shocking the conscience. Of course, we submit that if the court does reach that question, that the cases are quite clear that substantive due process is a very limited doctrine, and it requires a showing well beyond simply bad conduct, tortious conduct, even abhorrent conduct does not suffice. And we cite the Tunn versus Whitaker case in our brief, which canvasses the decisions about what it takes to rise to the level of conscious shocking in the constitutional sense. Mr. Palka has alleged nothing that comes close, especially in light of the fact that what everybody agrees, which is that a stranger called the Tobias Children's School asking about their whereabouts, and when asked who he was, refused to give his identity and instead stated that he would like to send flowers to one of the children for a birthday. In light of that, if the individual city defendants in tracing that phone call and investigating that phone call, if in fact it's true the allegations Mr. Palka makes that there were corners cut or statutes or rules or regulations violated, that does not rise to the level of conscience shocking in the constitutional sense. Turning to Mr. Palka's occupational liberty claim, he failed to allege two necessary elements to make out a claim against the individual city defendants. First, he failed to allege that the comments that he claimed stigmatized him were disseminated publicly in a manner that would reach potential future employers. And second, he failed to allege that he lost any tangible opportunity for employment as a result. It's not enough to allege that he might not be able to get a job. He has to actually have attempted and had that effort come up short in order to state an occupational liberty.
What's the situation with the badge and the firearm certificate?
Your Honor, I don't know because I represent the city defendants, and we did not employ Mr. Palka, so I will leave that question to the county defendants to address, but we weren't able to give him his badge or his credentials.
There was publication of comment between the various police agencies at issue here, though, wasn't there? Just didn't go beyond those agencies.
That's correct, Your Honor. This court's Ratliff case requires that the comments be disseminated in a manner that it would reach potential future employers. And, of course, the county was already employing Mr. Palka. It wasn't a potential future employer. So the comments that the city defendants made to the county would not meet the test under this court's decision in Ratliff. And even if the comments were publicly disseminated, there is still no allegation on Mr. Palka's part that he lost a tangible opportunity for employment as a result, which is also a necessary element. The district court did not decide on that basis, but of course that does not limit this court. It can decide on any basis supported by the record. Unless there are further questions, we respectfully request that this court affirm the judgment of the district court with respect to the city defendants.
Thank you, Ms. Layton.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Zabru?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Teresa Abreu, and I represent the county defendants. Plaintiff attempts to allege a Section 1983 violation, specifically procedural due process, substantive due process, and occupational liberty claim. With respect to a property interest, plaintiff did not adequately plead that he had one. As Young v. Drury Lane, the Seventh Circuit said that a collective bargaining agreement doesn't equal a contract of employment. As Your Honor pointed out, he would need to allege that within that CBA existed that a clause that said he could only be terminated for cause, or if there was some sort of state law that would allow him to have this property interest. Specifically with procedural due process claim, he pled himself out. He admits to being placed on paid suspension pending the investigation. Suspension with pay doesn't equal a deprivation of property right. Additionally, plaintiff admits to resigning before his case could be heard before the merit board. Your Honor asked some questions about the Sheriff's Merit Board. The Sheriff's Merit Board is an independent entity which hears cases of accusations of violations of general orders. Should those general orders be sustained, the case moves to the merit board if the remedy sought by the sheriff is over a 29-day suspension. So just because the case is in front of the merit board, it doesn't mean that termination is necessarily requested by the sheriff, nor does it mean that the person will actually be terminated. There's two things that the merit board looks at. One, whether general orders were violated, and then two, what's the appropriate sentence, whether termination should warrant or whether there should be some sort of suspension. The plaintiff chose not to avail himself to this opportunity.
Is the merit board the final authority under the law?
If the merit board sustains the allegations and seeks termination, right, or recommends termination, the plaintiff would have an opportunity to seek administrative review.
Okay.
On top of that, he would be able to go to the appellate courts. So it's our position that the administrative remedies are sufficient for him.
So it goes from the merit board, I mean, it's a standard civil service structure, right? So
correct.
It goes from the merit board to an internal administrative appeal?
No. It goes from the sheriff seeking termination.
Right.
The case is before the sheriff's merit board, which is an independent agent,
right,
independent entity.
Right.
If they determine that termination is warranted, then the plaintiff has the option of appealing that decision to the Illinois courts.
Okay, so it goes from the merit board
to Chancery. And then if they affirm the sheriff's merit board, then he could go to the Illinois appellate court.
Okay.
So our position is that that's adequate. Specifically, Dargis is dispositive on this issue, and that the Seventh Circuit held a hearing before the merit board remedied any due process violation. With respect to substantive due process, plaintiff alleges that defendants violated this when they conducted an investigation of him and brought him up on charges before the merit board. Plaintiff admits that Tobias made a complaint with the sheriff's department alleging that one of the sheriff's employees called the school and made threatening phone calls. The sheriff had the obligation to conduct the investigation, and that's why it was forwarded to the Internal Affairs Division of the sheriff. Once at the Internal Affairs Division, they do their investigation and determine whether the general orders were violated by the employee. And once it's sustained, it then goes through the command channel review. Substantive due process protects individuals from the exercise of government power without reasonable justification. The plaintiff doesn't allege facts that the sheriff's decision to investigate the Tobias allegations was arbitrary or irrational, and that any additional constitutional violations occurred. Nor does he state that the available state remedies here were inadequate. And even if he had, our argument is that it is, and that he could have appealed the mayor board decision. Additionally, the facts alleged by plaintiff with respect to the investigation would not shock the conscience. With respect to the occupational liberty claim, the most important fact that is omitted by the plaintiff is that it was publicly made. The only allegation that the plaintiff makes with respect to the sheriff's department is that the sheriff contacted the state's attorney's office to possibly move forward on some criminal charges, in which they didn't.
How about the firearms papers and the retirement badge?
First, the retirement badge is something that's discretionary. It's not something that's mentioned in the collective bargaining agreement. The only time that a retirement credential is given by the sheriff is when they're in good standing. And when an employee is before the merit board, that's indicative that they are not in good standing. So that is why plaintiff would not have received that. The firearm...
So by retiring while under investigation, he, in effect, pretermitted any possibility of his getting this? Is that true?
Absolutely. It's not something that's an automatic thing that the sheriff gives to its employees. You know, they look on an individual basis, but also, most importantly, that they're in good standing. And based on the conclusion of the investigation, they found that there was merit to the claims and that it was going before the merit board. So he didn't have the option of the retirement badge. In terms of the FOID card, I'm not sure if that's in the possession of the sheriff. That isn't something that is tended to take away. I don't know the basis of that fact.
The firearm
owner's identification, the FOID card, that plaintiff mentioned in his argument.
He appears to allege that this is something you get from your county employer when you leave.
Well, in order to carry a firearm...
If you don't have it, you don't get a job as a former police officer in a security firm.
Well, that's something that the individual applies for the firearm owner's credential. So it doesn't necessarily mean that he can't get another position within law enforcement. I don't know the basis of that argument for him with respect to the FOID card.
Is he free to apply for one now?
I would think so. I don't know how the sheriff in seeking termination would stop that from happening. The point is that he didn't even move through the mayor board process. He could have argued his case and he could have been exonerated, but we don't know that. Not everyone that's before the mayor board that the sheriff seeks termination actually gets terminated. In closing, I think it's important to point out that plaintiff was given three opportunities to come up with a viable Section 1983 claim, and he's unable to do so. We ask that you affirm the district court's dismissal of the third amended complaint with prejudice. Thank you.
Thank you. Much time. Mr. Platt, you were out of time, but I'll give you 1 minute for a response.
Well, we just heard something I found very interesting. So if you're accused by the Merit System Board, you're going to the Merit System Protection Board, the fact that you go there and then it's dropped because you resign, that means that you're not in good standing and you don't get credentials. That's the same as meaning that if they file a complaint against you but then it's withdrawn, that means that you're guilty as charged whether you go through the prosecution. If that's not a violation of somebody's constitutional rights, I don't know what is. And in terms of if there's any additional things that the Sheriff's Department did, they did threaten criminal prosecution. They did not move forward on it. That's not true. They did move forward on it. The record shows that they did refer to the state's attorney. The only reason he wasn't prosecuted is that the state's attorney refused to prosecute him. So there were additional prosecution elements that were involved. And in terms of whether or not there was anything else that shocks the conscience, they sent two commander-level police officers outside the jurisdiction of Chicago to Norridge, Illinois, at 10:30 at night. They threatened his neighbor, who was 9 years old, and scared her because they pounded on her door looking for Mr. Palka. They threatened him if he didn't drop the claim against Mr. Tobias and stop bothering him, stop trying to get his son reinstated. Now, maybe that doesn't shock the sheriff's department, but I think it's a matter of perspective. Is it five officers holding somebody at gunpoint like in Bivens? No. but it still shocks my conscience, and I think it's a matter of perspective. Maybe it didn't shock the judge, but I think it's equally as compelling, and it should shock somebody's conscience, and I think it is another issue. It's an issue. It's a matter of perspective. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Platt. Thanks to both counsel. Before we move to case number 4, we'll take a brief recess.